The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So, welcome everyone. Special welcome to anyone who's here for the first time. Tom is the program host, and you can connect with him afterwards if you have any questions. My name is Gabe, and I'm filling in for Mark, who's our guiding teacher. He's on retreat this week out at our retreat property, Prairie Farm. Before I share some reflections, I just wanted to see if there are any questions coming out of the meditation practice. So the question, if you couldn't hear it, was, when I said be wary of complexity, what did I mean? Well, in my experience, complexity can lead to a sense of struggle, a sense of basically it's hard to be really peaceful when the mind's complicated. Diverse, even, you could say, here and there, which is our usual frame of mind. It's really, for most of us, before we start practice, might be all we really know. We might have some moments, you know, walking in the woods or something, where the mind is collects itself because there's something interesting, so it collects itself. And if we pay attention in those moments where the mind has collected itself around any experience, we can taste that sense of peace. So that's really was pointing to that sense of peace, and that while complexity can be beautiful, you know, complex works of art and the complex thinking it requires to live our lives, in meditation practice, we're getting interested in simplicity, because it's not our modus operandi. Because there's something to learn from our fixation on complexity. Any other questions coming out of the meditation? Okay, so the topic tonight is liberation. So if you're interested in freedom, you came to the right place. And so for those of you who've been in the Buddhist scene or come here, you might have heard words like liberation, freedom, translations of the Pali word Nibbana or Sanskrit Nirvana. And I remember coming to Common Ground 9 years ago, not having much exposure to meditation or Buddhism, really. But, you know, this word and this idea, enlightenment, is out in our popular culture. And I remember asking Mark, basically, trying to understand what that would be like. So that seemed like a really important question, to understand what would that actually be like to be have a mind that was free of suffering. So I was interested in it, not really knowing what it was, but I think also just I kind of smile and laugh when I remember that, because there's so much baggage, there's so much as a concept it's very interesting. And either we were enticed by it, or I know for me too, sometimes it's like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, that's not realistic. Like, why even talk about that? What does that actually mean? How is that useful? So, in the talk, I want to explore this concept, explore our views around it, our relationship to, basically our relationship to our motivation for practice. And to try to put this concept of liberation in a more practical frame. So I think it's always good to be reflective about our practice and not do it in a rote way. And why are we practicing? And with the secularization and the popularization of mindfulness and meditation, with it, which is, I think, probably on the whole good. But you hear terms like stress reduction, like mindfulness-based stress reduction, and that's kind of the main framework. And who wouldn't want stress reduction? And sometimes I think about what if they called it mindfulness-based stress elimination forever. It might not sound as realistic. And I think there's dangers to that as a way of understanding what the Buddha was pointing to, because, you know, putting it out in the future, someday if I work really hard, if I try really hard, meditate every day, go on a lot of retreats, then someday I'll be free. So I think there's dangers of that end of it as well. But I think this word liberation or this word freedom can be pointing to something a lot more accessible that we maybe experience even every day. And we can think about it in different ways, like even relative freedom, like on a level of time, like through our practice, those of us who have been practicing for a while, we can probably access some sense of freedom, of liberation, just because certain habit patterns of our mind aren't as sticky as they used to be. We don't get caught as much. And that's liberation. Like, that's one of my teachers, Steve Armstrong, at the end of a retreat, was talking about kind of the value of this practice. And he said something like, it's like we're in jail. How much would you pay to be free? You know, it's priceless. And even in a moment, in a day, where we're caught up in some drama, and then maybe we get distracted, or maybe the mind, just because of the momentum of practice, realizes it can put it down, and that's a moment of liberation. The mind is free in that moment of the torments of whatever it was previously caught up in. So I think, like, honoring this aspiration, however we might frame it to ourselves, but to see that it's, we don't just aspire for stress reduction. Like, yeah, I just want a little less stress. Then I'd be happy. Like, you know, maybe for some of us who are really struggling at different points, we just want some relief. But even that, there's a flavor of the mind really valuing or really intuiting something, a potential of the mind to be free. And there's a story that I read recently in the New York Times that kind of reminded me of this deep yearning for freedom. And it's about Ona Maria Judge, who was enslaved black woman, enslaved and was owned by George Washington, and she escaped and basically spent the rest of her life as a fugitive, avoiding George Washington's attempts to find her and bring her back. And this is a really interesting article, just for me, for all the historical pieces that you can see, like the actual newspaper clippings that George Washington put in the papers. You know, I'm looking for this person. And then the interviews with Ona Maria Judge. And and one point that stood out to me was in these interviews with her, how she really wanted to be free. And you know, with all the delusion and the oppression, but, you know, what was so powerful in this system of racism is the idea. So like, oh, why would you want to, you know, it wasn't a bat, you know, you weren't in the fields, but this yearning for freedom. And she lived in poverty. She had two kids and, you know, by no means lived a probably very pleasant life. It might have been in some ways more pleasant, but she said something like, once the Washingtons died, she didn't know where she would be. But even more than that, just that sense of freedom. So I'll read there's some interesting, this is a book, The Island, an anthology of the Buddha's teachings on Nibbana. So it's a whole book on this topic. I highly recommend it. It's given out freely, so I don't know exactly where you can get one, but it might be online as a PDF, I'm not sure. And that we have one in the reference library for sure. But anyways, I'll just like to read a little bit of some of these different names for liberation, for freedom. And in the community room, we have a mobile of 33, maybe, of these names. So you might look at that sometime. So these are just different names the Buddha used for this concept. It is the unformed, the unconditioned, the end, the truth, the other shore, the subtle, the everlasting, the invisible, the undiversified, peace, the deathless, the blessed, safety, the wonderful, the marvelous, Nibbana, purity, freedom, the island, the refuge, the beyond. And then one other quote, having nothing, clinging to nothing, that is the island. There is no other. That is Nibbana, I tell you, the total ending of aging and death. So how do we relate to this? It can seem so otherworldly. So I would recommend looking, you know, trying to make it real for us. Do we have anything in our experience that remotely resembles some of these concepts? And probably all of us have had experiences, even if it's we didn't quite understand them. And to really value that. Like it really is a really beautiful thing when the mind is in just a moment not caught up in self-preservation. So these ordinary moments, maybe everyday moments, if we notice them, with clarity, kindness, forgiveness, just simple presence. And the more we get interested in these moments, then the more they grow. It's like we have to get familiar with them. And it's really not our habit for most of us. And you might have heard in some of the words that are used, this flavor of the unconditioned. So one way that it's talked about in Ajahn Sumedho, a monk, senior monk in the Theravada Thai forest tradition, talks a lot about this using different metaphors like the space in the room or the sound of silence. So there's I used the word otherworldly a minute ago, and that word is used in the suttas, but it's not otherworldly as in transcendent, as in somewhere else, as in the future. So the unconditioned. So these metaphors like the space in the room or the sound of silence, they're pointing to the mind that's not fixed on any condition. So there's still conditions. There's always conditions coming and going. But what is that experience of the mind in the middle of everything, but not fixed, not for or against? And so it's, the Buddha used that word subtle too, and maybe if I can find it, there's this nice line of right after the Buddha's awakening. Yeah, here it is. Kind of talking about how subtle this is. So this is from Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro, who compiled this book. They say, after listing all of these terms, and there's even more than the ones I listed, the unborn, the unoriginated, the unconditioned element, the standstill of the cycle of existence. These terms are all ways of referring to the same essential and ineffable quality. Such a variety of expression was needed, since even the Buddha acknowledged that it was hard to convey the realization of truth in words. He describes a time shortly after his enlightenment. So this is the Buddha. I considered, this Dhamma that I have realized is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced only by the wise. But this generation delights in worldliness, takes delight in worldliness, rejoices in worldliness. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely, specific conditionality, dependent origination. And it is hard to see this truth, namely, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. So, if you know the story, the Buddha wasn't going to teach because he just thought it wouldn't be worth it. But apparently a celestial being came and said, out of compassion, please teach. There's some people who will get this. So apparently that's us. In moments, at least. But it is subtle. Unattainable by mere reasoning. That's an important one for me as a very analytical mind. And I think in general for us in the West, where we value so much reasoning, and that's been something I've been playing with in my practice a lot recently, like meaning. Because this unconditioned element, meaning is conditional, right? We learn that as we grow up, and we see that the way we were raised isn't the same way other people are raised, or we go live abroad and we see, oh, meaning is conditional. What I take to be meaningful, I think it's meaningful because someone told me, or So we just see that. And it's not to say that meaning isn't something, or that we can't live in a society and participate. But if the mind's attached to meaning, taking it to be more than what it is, then we get into arguments. For example, there's a new book out by Gil Fronsdahl, who's a teacher on the West Coast near San Francisco. The book's called The Buddha Before Buddhism, and it's really interesting. And a lot of it, it's kind of, he's trying to distill as much as he can. He's a scholar as well. The earliest teachings, and a lot of what we think of as Buddhism is missing a lot of these lists, and it's very, like, it comes down to some really core teachings, and one of them that just repeated over and over is this teaching on fixed views. And it's not just fixed political views, but any view that we're fixed on. Like right now, we could have a fixed view that this is a good talk or this is a bad talk, or I'm enjoying this or I'm not. But is it necessary for the mind to be fixed, to be fixed on a meaning in order to be here, to be a functional human being, to take in the meaning of the words? So you might notice a sense of fear, maybe, or distrust, or confusion when talking about this concept. Because our ground as an ego is in conditions. We feel good when our hair looks good, or we have money in the bank, and those are real conditions that have an impact on our lives. And obviously all of us here have enough privilege to even be considering a deeper, more resonant happiness, but for most of the people on the planet, that's really not possible because the conditions of their life demand so much attention to surviving. So obviously, conditions are real. So, how interested are we in freedom, in liberation, unconditionally, like, no matter what, like, if we got in a terrible accident on the way home and couldn't walk for the rest of our lives? And another way of talking about this is refuge, and where are we, in a sense, where do we put our trust? Kind of a simple way of talking about this is a quote from Joseph Goldstein. Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And often, even though that's kind of specific to maybe an argument or something, but I find that it applies quite broadly as well. Like, do I want to know what's going on in a personal way? Do I want to feel like I have control personally? Is that where I'm placing my trust in my life? Or do I want to be happy? And sometimes, probably most of the time, we kind of we trust our habits of controlling enough that we really have to, through paying attention, have to see how they don't work. And so a lot of us come to the practice when things stop working for different reasons. Because if things are working well enough, we might not be interested in a deeper happiness. So there's a poem that's quite popular, you may have heard, but I think it's talking about this shift in allegiance, shift in refuge. It's called Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to gaze at bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. I also saw in the window of a store on Lake Street recently, it was East Lake Street, it was like a art shop, maybe a like etching store or something, and they had some cool art in the window, and one of them said, "Things may not work out for you." Like... So, so the Buddha's invitation is really radical. It's not stress reduction. Well, as nice as that is, it's liberation, no matter the conditions. And why wouldn't we be interested in that? Maybe because we don't think it's possible or we don't feel worthy. Like, no, I think I just deserve stress reduction. But it's actually not about whether we're worthy, and we don't even have to know that. We're not required to believe anything. It's an invitation to look and see for ourselves. And there's some nice epithets or terms, descriptions of Dhamma, the way it is, visible here and now, to be experienced by the wise, inviting. Another, so on this point of getting interested or having some faith or some curiosity around freedom, around liberation, it's interesting that in the Buddha's own life story, so he tried a lot of different things after setting out on his spiritual quest. He tried a lot of ascetic practices, really mortifying his body. Found that didn't really lead to freedom. And as the story goes, he decided to take food again, and then I think it was at this point that he had a memory that arose from being a child, where he was sitting and watching his father, who was the chieftain of the village or fiefdom. So he was just sitting under a tree and watching this plowing ceremony going on, and he was under the shade. And just naturally his mind apparently slipped into the first absorption, I think, which is a technical term, but basically just slipped into a state of calm, of gathering the mind, being unified, because he was happy. So he was just sitting there. And so the Buddha later, the Bodhisattva, the Buddha to be, had just spontaneously remembered this. And he thought, could this be the way? And then it's interesting, he asked himself, because he'd been doing all these ascetic practices, which were really their philosophy was that by mortifying the body, basically, like what they understood was conditioned phenomena are limited, which is part of the Buddha's understanding as well, but they took it to the conclusion that then the only thing to do is to try to deny all of the real bodily needs and everything. Anyways, so the Buddha remembered this moment of happiness, but his thought was, can this be trusted? Like, is there any reason to not trust this? Like, this is pleasant, like I thought. I thought it was all about torturing myself, but this seems pleasant and useful, like this collected mind, this gathered mind. Is there anything dangerous about this? And I find that an interesting reflection, that's what arose. This mistrust of peace, you could say. Could this really be the way? Like, and we have, I know at least I do, conditioning around that in our modern world, especially in times like these where there's so much suffering all around. Like, is it okay to be peaceful? But the Buddha investigated and decided, no, this doesn't seem to be dangerous. And that's sort of the turning point in his practice. That the power of that mind that's not caught up to see clearly. Related quote to that point that I like by Audre Lorde is, self-care is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare. As I was reflecting on this talk, I was also remembering, for those of you who've listened to, forget what the album is, Beyoncé's second most recent album, but where in one of the songs she's being asked, what's your greatest aspiration in life? She says, to be happy. And like how challenging that feels. But I think part of, at least in my experience, what's helped me, because I really have this conditioning just a lot around, this, for who knows what reasons, but this martyr complex or like, but like appreciating the beauty, like the objective beauty of a mind that's settled, a mind that's at peace, even relatively, the power, not just the beauty, but the power of a mind that in a moment is trustworthy, in a moment it's not in the animal mode for a moment. And what a mind in that mode is capable of is more available to the world. And to be honest, as much as this makes sense for us, that this question of suffering and the end of suffering, of liberation, it's actually the most interesting thing to us. Now, we might not think that. But I've just been finding that, like, well, partly it's like everything else seems to work a lot better when I put liberation front and center. Like, if I'm trying to live my life, even with really wholesome intentions, to be a good person, to make change in the world, it doesn't seem to work as well. But when I'm placing when I'm really honest, as much as I am really interested in social justice, in helping my family and friends be happy, what on a moment-to-moment level, this mind, it doesn't like feeling caught up. It doesn't like feeling tight. And it's really, it's frustrated about that, and it's confused. It doesn't know why it keeps getting caught up in the same patterns that cause myself suffering and cause others suffering. It's really interesting. And if, yeah, and noble, you, I think it's, this is a noble and courageous undertaking. Another related quote to that is, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and do that, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And again, we can get into debates, you know, all the monks out there meditating should come back, and what are they doing? So we can get into arguments around it, but it's about our own experience, like trusting our own experience. Not even that we have to, you know, these kind of false dichotomies about engaging in the world and doing this practice. We know what that experience is like, even if we've just had tastes of it, where the mind is in this space of being completely available, this taste of freedom. The Buddha also, in another discourse, talked about this taste of freedom, how it's unforgettable, and once we taste it, we can really, we have to practice really trusting that. This is really valuable. So I really appreciate this. So I'll end with reading a bit from a discourse, famous discourse called the Heartwood Sutta. And then we'll have some time to share and discuss. So, see if I can find it. So, just to set up the scene, the metaphor is somebody going and looking for the heartwood of a tree to make something. But first they just take the branches, thinking that's the heartwood. And then they take the outer bark. I'm having trouble finding it here. Oh yeah, here it is. So it's a long discourse, and it goes through this metaphor of somebody collecting different parts of a tree, but keeping on looking deeper, deeper. What's the heartwood? So I'll just read the end of the discourse. So the Buddha says, practitioner, this holy life doesn't have as its reward gain, offerings, and fame, doesn't have as its reward consummation of virtue, doesn't have as its reward consummation of concentration, doesn't have as its reward knowledge and vision, but the unprovoked awareness release. That is the purpose of this holy life. That is its heartwood, that its final end. So these other things are good too. Gain, offerings, and fame, virtue, concentration, knowledge, and vision. Another translation for the unprovoked awareness release is the unshakable deliverance of the mind. So I'll leave it there and open it up now. Questions or sharings from your own experience to help us understand, you know, it can, these moments can be so ordinary that we overlook them. A moment where you realized, oh, this happened 10 years ago when I wasn't practicing, I would have exploded, but now there's more space in the mind. Or any of these other ordinary moments of liberation. Or any questions? And we'll use the mic. You want to pass it back that way?
Hi, my name is Kermit. Thank you very much, Gabe. That's kind of a big, challenging topic you took on there. You asked what liberation would look like, and I think this is kind of what you're saying. I think it would look like right here and now. I mean, what else is there? You know, where are you going to go? I think if you truly had right here and now with nothing added onto it, no drama, no craving and all these things. And I think if you really had a sense that, this instant is the only time there is, I think that would just contain everything. I had an experience about 30 years ago where I briefly stumbled onto that state of mind. I didn't know anything about Buddhism or anything like that, but like you say, you noticed it, you know, and it's something, you know, I can't really describe, and, you know, of course, I tried grabbing for it, clinging to it, and that was the end of that, you know, but I know a Tibetan guy who says, don't worry about the big enlightenment. Worry about the small one. Worry about just realizing that your mind is taking you for a ride. And I find that a lot more accessible in this language about, you know, going to the other shore and mm-hmm. stuff. I don't know what that is, you know, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. I sometimes I know when my mind is taking me for a ride. So thank you.
Thanks, Kermit. And that's why the Buddha kind of refrained from, you know, talking a lot about Nibbana in positive terms. Like, there's some, but often, I mean, one definition of Nibbana is the cessation of greed, anger, and delusion. And for most of us, that's a lot more familiar, greed, anger, and delusion. So we can notice Nibbana, moments of liberation, when those fires die down for a moment, then what's that like? And it might not be what we think we're looking for.
Yeah, it's like the refrigerator shuts.
Right, 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 yeah.
Hi, I'm Michael. I've been encouraged recently in my practice. I wanted to say I was lucky enough to stumble upon a young adult retreat about a year ago here at Common Ground, a day-long retreat, and that was kind of my first exposure to coming to Common Ground and really getting into my practice. And I met up with a group of people who had been there the next day for tea, and I was sitting in this group having meditated maybe once or twice, and these, my friends now, these people were talking about, like, what is enlightenment? Like, let's really get to the bottom of this. Like, let's see if we can figure out what's going on. And I was just sitting in amazement, like, what, are you guys seriously considering trying to do this? Like, it seems so outlandish. And like, but I really understood at that moment that I do have this part of me that feels kind of unworthy, or like just never considered myself as like the type of person who could go for something like that. So I don't think it's super helpful for me in my practice to think about this high up goal of liberation, but I do start to see these little practical liberations. And one example comes to mind. I went to a 10-day retreat about a year ago, and I left on day 8. I made it a long time, but I came up against really strong resistance, and I just wanted to go home. I kind of was defeated. And then I just recently, about a month ago, came back from another 10-day retreat where I came up to similar resistance and got some more encouragement from the teacher and everything and made it through. And I really feel like I was able to release a lot of things. But the situation that I wanted to bring up is about a year ago, I was having some pain in a knee that I've had 2 surgeries on, and I was really having a lot of anxiety about that because my work is very physical and wondering if I would be able to continue on doing that or not, if I had to get another surgery or something. But that anxiety lasted about 2 or 3 days, and I was really taking it out on my coworkers and a lot of self-destructive behaviors of using substances and binge eating to regulate my emotions. And then after this retreat and being more consistent in my practice, I've been having some pain in my shoulder that's also kind of disturbing and puts into question the amount of work that I'm able to do. But so pretty much the same situation came up, and I was just able to see it, the anxiety come up, and I now have the capacity to actually feel that emotion and then turn to self-nurturing behaviors instead of those self-destructive behaviors. And it passed away so much more quickly. It was about a few hours instead of lasting like 3 days. So it's really cool to see that progress, and gives me a lot of inspiration to keep going.
Thanks, Michael. That reminds me of this image in the suttas of like a ship that's beached on the beach, and so the waves are coming in, and the ship just still looks like it's intact, but the waves just keep going, and that's our practice. And then one day, you know, a gust of wind comes and the whole thing falls. So sometimes it's like that. Sometimes we can see those moments like you did. We see them. Oh, yeah. And then other times, like, yeah, just the things don't bother us as much. But that's the result of all of that practice. Other thoughts?
First, thank you, Gabe, for the teaching. So one of the things that this brings up for me, I love the Hartwood Sutta, and it brings up this dichotomy that's being played out in my life right now between the goals of the practice, the unshakable liberation of the heart and mind, versus at times the goals I have in my life, right? The moving forward and advancing professionally and pushing through in various ways, many of which very wholesome, very, very beautiful. Just not exactly the same as the goals of the practice. And they can inform each other, but in moments like these, with the Hartwood Sutta, or just with it, when different things that come up in life, it brings the two in stark relief that at times those aren't the same thing. And even the story of Ona Judd, you know, like, I appreciate that story too, because, you know, she, by all accounts, lived a very privileged life with Martha Washington beforehand, but gave that up for freedom. And when as a metaphor, you know, she gave it up for practical freedom, but her life when she was free wasn't as cushy. You know, there was more suffering. She was more aware of the muck and mire of life. And I feel that come up in my own life. Like, I can, at times, the practice, it has me a lot more aware of the muck and mire of my own life. And it'd be a lot easier if I could just turn off this mindfulness thing and just push through. And, but it's not, you know, it said, for those who have not started the practice, better yet to not begin. I know, but for those who have, better to complete the practice. So I just appreciate, you know, I appreciate the teaching today because it very much is, it's being played out in my life right now. So again, thank you.
I'm Don, and I was wondering how equanimity kind of plays into that. I had an experience of that a couple weeks ago, and I did feel a sense of freedom in that, and it was one of the things. It wasn't really I don't really give myself over to anything and say. But I went ahead and did this thing because it was kind of a service to somebody else. And I wasn't really happy about it. But once I was in the process, everything didn't have to be a certain way. I wasn't getting pushed around like, oh, this isn't right. I got to do this. I mean, I had kind of some little doubt things, but it was like, I knew that, like, I was on a mission, and it was a right mission to do, but it wasn't from me. I didn't really want to do it, but I ended up doing it, and I, all of a sudden, I realized I wasn't being pushed around by my mind, and so I think this is equanimity, and that, to me, felt like a sense of freedom, because I was free from that I had to have things my way.
Right. We think freedom is having all the choices and being able to choose whichever one we want, right? But that reminds me of just as I've been reflecting. I work here, I'm teaching here occasionally, but kind of also going back to Femi's point, like. Where are we really taking refuge? Like, when we really look honestly, and it's probably changes moment to moment in different moments, but like, why, if there's something that we're finding in our own experience that we really trust, like, really, like, I could say, you know, that we can see, oh yeah, this being aware in this stable, non-judgmental way that allows things to be known and seen more clearly, or this sense of kindness, or whatever it is that we really trust for ourselves, if we really trust that and we're really investigating that and learning about it and deepening our faith in that, then it's going to cause changes in our life because our life is going to orient around that. And why wouldn't we, the more we trust that, why wouldn't we completely give our life away? That's kind of what I heard in what you were saying. And I've had that experience too in different moments where that sense of freedom isn't arising because I got just what I wanted, but it's arising because the life is just giving itself to what it trusts, which in that moment is, I trust that in this moment I need to take care of this person. And it's so enlivening. That reminded me too of a story of a friend who, had a moment like that one morning when his dog pooped in his kitchen. And like, he wasn't thinking of anything else. He just had to take care of it. But his mind was just right there. And that was a moment of liberation. It's like these moments where it's just, yeah, anyways. So we have to leave it here. Really appreciate everyone being here. May we all recognize these moments of liberation and appreciate them so that they may continue to grow and be of benefit for ourselves and all beings. Thanks.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.